G'day and welcome to a Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is CJ the DJ and I am your host for this week's Grad Chat. Of course, a show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs as well as CFRC. So thank you very much to both of them. Now, if you may miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, and CFRC Podcast. So no excuse not to hear what our awesome students and postdoctoral fellows are doing. Today, though, I would like to introduce you to Basma Rahman, who is doing a PhD in English Literature under the supervision of Dr. Heather McFarlane. Welcome to Grad Chat, Basma.
Hello, it's lovely to be here.
Well, I know your good friend and mine, as well as our editor here for Grad Chat, Su Yin, finally got you to say yes to coming on the show. So what took you so long?
I think I wanted to get my ducks in order, as they say. I wanted to make sure that I really knew what I was saying in terms of my research and where it's taken me. And that took some writing time. So I think I'm ready now. And I'm excited to share what I've found in my research.
Okay, well, before we get on to that, though, I want to know a little bit more about your background on you. So what got you interested in literature in the first place? I mean, why do that? Why do a PhD in English literature, even though I know it's fascinating?
Yeah, so I found stories to be such a alternative space to think about the world. And you could gain perspectives that you might not necessarily see in your day-to-day. And I really, really enjoyed that throughout my childhood. And in high school, I realized that it could be something that I could study. I love the way that different social issues could tie into literature. I love the way that writing could be so beautiful, how it could move you, and also make you laugh and cry and do all of that. So that's why I chose to study literature instead of another field. And then education sort of got tied on to that.
So with that, though, because I know when I read a book, I read it for pure pleasure of it. And you said, yes, it can give all sorts of emotions while you're reading, etc. But one of the reasons I like to read literature is because I don't want to think too hard. Yeah. But it sounds like when you're reading literature, you're analysing it. You know, what's the hidden messages behind it? Is it part of that curiosity or detective side? You know, what is it? I mean, can you just sit back and read and not analyze it?
I can. At the moment, though, I'm having trouble doing that just given the fact that I'm researching. So whenever I read a Canadian piece of literature, I just automatically go into the analysis mode. But before that, I do read for pleasure, because I think I have to find some joy in what I'm reading. And then I decide whether I want to analyze it or not, and whether it will be something that I pursue in some research format or not. But I think at the beginning for reading, I do prioritize finding joy in it.
Oh, well, that's good. And then outside the academic side, even if you're just reading for the pure pleasure, do you discuss some of the books you read with your mates and things? Just as a general thing, like at the old good old book club where people used to get together and go, what do you think of this book?
Yes, of course. And I'm a huge advocate for public libraries. I realized in some of my friends, they didn't know that a library card was free.
Oh, I know. It's silly, isn't it?
Right? And I was just like, oh, no. Like, this is an amazing public service. And not only do you have access to books, you have access to movies, podcasts, magazines, thermal cameras if you want to rent out.
Oh, don't know that part.
Wondering if your house is leaking. It's very useful.
But it's interesting when you mention libraries, because I think a lot of people these days see it as a dying institution, which is so, well, in my opinion, it's such a wrong thing. Because you're right, libraries are free. They have all these opportunities, books, as well as you said, films and things. They have activities for kids. And what better way to get kids involved in literature and reading than to take them to a place where they're surrounded by books and things like that? Because I've always wondered whether, I remember growing up, we always had a book to take home because you had to read.
Yeah.
But we couldn't afford to just purchase books all the time. So you went to the local library to get the book. and if it wasn't provided by the school, is you went to the library, and it was actually fun, and then sort of realizing, oh my goodness, I've got to take it back because I'm going to expire, kind of thing. And I think it's a lost art of going to the public library.
Yeah, I love going to the library. I go every week because I have a yoga class in the community center that holds a library.
Oh, right.
And I just like perusing around to see what people are doing. And it's actually quite refreshing to see how many people are there, families are there on
That's
a Wednesday
good.
Evening. It's lovely to see how they're bonding, how there's a sense of community there. And I live in Ottawa right now on the unsurrendered territory of the Anishinaabe and Algonquin people. So it's very different to see such large community hubs now, and just people from different walks of life using the resources, the computers, the printer, and everything. And I think the library is such a wonderful resource that we really should use because it can bring so many people together.
I know a lot of our grad students, because I mean, on campus, there's limited space sometimes of where you can go and do your own studies without bumping into an undergrad. So I know there's been quite a few grad students who will go to the local libraries to sit and do their writing and things. And as you said, they create a little community, get a few of their mates, they go along, go to the library, write for a few hours, then go for a coffee or something like that. And yeah, no, it's a wonderful institution, and I'm glad they're not going the way of the dodo. So
no, and like I love when you're working, because I will go work there sometimes, but I will start going through the aisles, and I always gravitate towards the graphic novels because it's so nice to look at the pictures and not read just text. Again, that excitement of picking up something new and reading it that you were talking about, going to the library and taking a pile of books, and also seeing it sort of as like, wow, look, I'm going to try and get through all these books, like a badge of honor.
Well, that's good. Yes. How many books can you read in 1 year?
Yeah.
I know when I eventually retire, that's on my bucket list because I love reading. Yeah. Sundays to me is my day for reading.
Maybe Colette, we can start a book club.
We can start a book club. Absolutely. That would be awesome. So I guess we should get onto your actual research, because we know we both love books.
Yeah.
And your research topic. Oh, and I should say too, part of your background is you are an actual teacher, right?
Yes, I am.
And what was your predominant discipline? I'm assuming English?
Yes, it was English, literature, and history. Those are my two teachables, so the two subjects that I can teach. I'm a concurrent education alumni from Queens.
Right.
And there we did practicums every year, basically, at least when I was there. I know the practicum system has changed a little bit. I loved literature, and I would love to teach it to youth, which is why I went into education as well.
And the reason I wanted to bring up your background, because I think that's relevant to your topic, of course, that you've chosen, because I don't know whether people believe this or not, but I don't think we do enough reading and looking at diverse cultures and things within our readings. So your research topic is Canadian BIPOC literature and educational pedagogies.
Yes.
Can you give us an overview of what you're doing there and why you wanted to combine education with literature?
Yeah, for sure. So in the simplest terms, what my project looks at is how different diverse literatures can inform our teaching pedagogies in high school classrooms, specifically because I was a high school teacher. And what teaching pedagogies are just the methods or frameworks that teachers are using in a classroom to teach a certain subject. I've chosen literature, one, I've spoken about my love for literature, but also it being a medium that's very relatable and accessible to many people. Yes, different writing can be on different levels, but it is something that you can train yourself to read. And then education I selected because education, it's a field that everyone's connected to in some way or another, right? There's schools in different communities, you know someone going to school, you've been to school yourself. And I'm not talking about university, I'm talking about primary and secondary education. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to bring those two things together because it seems like English classrooms can be a wonderful place for change, a wonderful place for social change, but more than that, it can be a wonderful place to grow community for the students and learn to uplift one another and see different perspectives. So that's why I brought the two together.
So before we go into more depth of that, then why did you register with the English Literature Department and not the education? Because you could have gone either by the sounds of it.
Yes, I could have. And I think that lies in my methodology. So one of my key methodologies in research is using a literary analysis lens. So I use close reading skills and the analysis of narrative structure. And that is my main means of research instead of taking, say, qualitative or quantitative data sets and analyzing that, which I think could be housed more in education. So in that way, I see literature as a primary source because there are people who've written it. It doesn't necessarily have to be nonfiction to have validity in the classroom. I primarily work with fictional texts, but they have those representations of what a classroom could have been like for a youth who was going through the system in Canada. And I particularly look at marginalized voices.
So tell us more about the marginalized voices, because as we know, a lot of the times in Canada, Australia, New Zealand, England, a lot of the books that we are given to read in the classroom are about white people and written by white people. So you get one version of literature.
Yeah.
So why have you now, particularly with everything that's going on right now with education, dare I say it, things are a bit tricky these days. Why did you want to highlight looking at literature and the social context of literature from a BIPOC point of view?
Yeah, so you just hit the nail on the head with the contentions that surround education and what canonical texts in the classroom look like. And to sort of extrapolate that, I further see the classroom as this microcosm of society where the hierarchies that govern a society are often replicated in the classroom, either through teaching, through classroom dynamics, so on and so forth. So by bringing in marginalized voices, and I know I mentioned Black, Indigenous, and people of color, but I'm also looking at different socioeconomic levels and representations of that. I'm also looking at critical disability studies in low socioeconomic white populations as well, because those voices are also on the margins.
And right.
Education isn't being accessed in equitable means. So that's sort of why I've chosen to bring in marginalized voices, because it offers that alternative perspective and can act as a site of representation for those students' voices that haven't been heard before. And that's not to say that people haven't brought in diverse texts into classrooms yet. There has been some ongoing change. But what I think educators struggle with is how to teach those texts with respect, because it's not just about having the text in the classroom. It's about approaching it, and it's about not isolating the students in the process, because that then becomes that one representation that's really pushed forward.
It's a tricky balance, isn't it? As you said, you know, how do you respect all sides, really?
Yeah.
To respect the author of the book, respect the content, respect the students in the classroom, and respect the society we are living in.
Yeah.
So what are some of the books that you're looking at to show these sort of marginalized groups? Are you looking at certain books to see what they do, or are you looking in general?
So I am looking at certain books, and then I'm hoping that at the end of my dissertation, I'll have an appendix that gives sample lesson plans about the books that I've chosen to include. Of course, you can go and find different texts within those categories as well, but it's to act as a framework of how to engage with the text. So my chapters are split into four body chapters, each one looking at a different marginalized group. So I have Indigenous texts, I have Black texts, I have refugee texts, and I have critical disabilities text as my last chapter.
And that's cool.
Yeah.
It's all very cool.
it's really fun. It is, I will say, a labor of love, because each chapter is like I'm writing a new comprehensive exam, because that's what I have to go into research in terms of frameworks, in terms of alternative pedagogies, in terms of texts and learning about specific cultures. So for example, in the Indigenous literature chapter, I'm writing on Monkey Beach by Eden Robinson, who's a Haisla author. So that's around the BC area.
Right.
And I'm looking specifically at land-based pedagogies and how we can incorporate them into literary classrooms. It's a way to increase student agency in Indigenous students, but also in non-Indigenous students, and really centering that agency of students, or seeing how they can bring their cultural means into the classroom as well.
So you mentioned land-based. So you're talking about the environment around the story and how they engage in the environment.
Yeah. So, or it's even the environment of your local classroom. Where
oh,
are
fair
you?
Enough. Right, right. Are you sitting in a four walls and a ceiling, or are you sitting
Yeah.
outside under a tree?
Yeah. And like, what do you know about your community, or what do you know about the Indigenous communities there and their ways of knowledge, and how is it different from what we're seeing in the classroom? Is it non-hierarchical? And if it is non-hierarchical, how is that benefiting your agency and community building?
Got
Right?
it.
So it's sort of taking away that competitive lens of
Yes.
classrooms and this grade-based desire to learn rather than learning for the sake of learning to uplift one another. And
I think I prefer the latter. Hated grades.
Oh, I'm not a fan of grades. I think it sometimes takes the joy out of learning.
It
Right?
does take the joy out of it. Makes me anxious. And
Right.
so that was the Indigenous. And the next one was the
Black literature.
Black literature.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in that one, I'm looking at Brother by David Cherryandi and Dear Current Occupant by Shalene Knight. And there I sort of look at specifically the surveillance of schools on Black youth and how that can cause them to sort of feel let down by the education system. And I specifically look at growing up in Scarborough because that's where Brother
Right.
takes place.
Right.
Shalene Knight's text takes place in Vancouver. So there are some parallels, of course, because education systems are provincially mandated in Canada. And I'm sort of looking at the way Black students are ostracized in the classrooms. And where do they look to find agency? And often it's outside of the classroom in different community sources. It could be in libraries. It could be amongst in places like barber shops. It could be in other places where they're fostering that community and they really feel uplifted by one another. And in Brother in particular, I look at the role of music in building agency in the classroom.
Right, right. And then the next one was
Refugee.
Yes, great one, particularly with Canada being so multicultural.
Yeah. So the next one, I'm looking at a short story collection by Suvankam Tamavongsa, who's a Laotian descent author, also based in Toronto. And it is a wonderfully witty, humorous book, and they're nice short stories. So I recommend everyone to read it, especially if you haven't read in a while. It's a great way to get into reading. And in that one in particular, I look at how we need a whole community approach in schools to support refugee students because they often feel like they're drowning in trying to acquire a new language and understanding the cultural nuances of classrooms. Some students may not have been in a formal learning environment, depending on where they're coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And that really impacts their sense of self, but also their confidence in learning.
Does language come into that? Because not everyone that comes here, English is their first language.
So yeah, language does, because in my career as a teacher, I also taught refugee students a lot.
Uh-huh.
And I volunteered with adult refugees as well for language education at local communities in Kingston as well. There's one, I forget the acronym, but it's called ISCA. And
yes.
I work with refugee students, a lot of Syrian refugee students, and I got to volunteer there. So language acquisition is a huge part of it. Reading and how we teach reading is another huge part of it. So there's two basic language skills that I look at within that chapter, and it's your basic interpersonal communication skills,
mm-hmm.
which is how we're speaking to one another, and that on
yep.
average I think takes 2 to 3 years to develop. But then your academic language acquisition skills take an average of 7 years to develop, which
oh.
is outside of the bracket of high school.
Right.
So how do we incorporate those language skills for these students who hope to go to post-secondary in some sort when we can't even give them the time to learn those academic skills?
And so these short stories then about refugees, these are stories telling their what it might be like as a refugee?
Yeah.
Is it? And so highlighting what they're going through so that us, the reader, can look at it in a different, a refugee in a different way. So, and they're not just coming here. These are the hurdles they have to go through, and it's been told through these stories.
Yeah, so I actually, it's interesting you mentioned that, because one of the things that I really break down is the gratitude narrative that's imposed on refugees, and this idea that they have to forever be grateful to the nation for being let in here, which is a pressure.
And it is a pressure.
Mm-hmm. And it's very, I would argue, neoliberal in proposing the sense of being a model citizen or becoming a model citizen, right? With the resources that they have. And what are the stresses between different generations of refugees? And how does that impact their home life and their relations as well? And one of the key aspects I look at is this idea of loneliness and how it can be amplified because of the dynamics between home and school in young children, in adults, in older children's. I do generational readings in all of my chapters, actually.
It's interesting when we look at the refugee side. I mean, I'm an immigrant. Unless you're Indigenous on Turtle Island, we're all immigrants, and yet we forget that part, right? And some of us have chosen to move here and luckily have been accepted, but others, because of what's happening in their homeland, didn't necessarily want to leave.
Yeah, but
have been forced to leave. And that adds that other element. When you use the word refugee as opposed to an immigrant, there's that distinction as well, isn't there?
Yeah, exactly. It's not having as much choice in the matter, right?
Mm-hmm. And we need to understand that's a different mindset.
Yeah, and I think one thing that brings all of my chapters together is the sense of longing. Right? What's common in all of my chapters is that everyone is displaced to a certain extent, whether it be from their homelands, right? Or the lands that they rightfully have access to, but no longer can. Or even the classroom, right? They're being displaced from there. So that's one thing that really brings them together and ties them to all of my chapters together.
And your last chapter's on disabilities.
Yes. So my last chapter has gone through many changes because it is the last chapter. Originally, I was going to look at rural white communities. Again, my chapters are very based on where I taught during my practicums. Right. And I am a Kingston native. I was born in Cataraqui. And I was placed in schools in and about Kingston, which included Sydenham and Gananoque and like the little hamlets around it. So I really wanted to look at that. But then I had trouble finding texts.
Right. Oh, that's a shame.
Right. Very practically speaking, I had trouble finding texts. So then I'm just like, okay, I will broaden it to low socioeconomic and see what I can find. And I went to a local reading by Ashley Elizabeth Best, and she had a poetry collection called Bad Weather Mammals. And she has some beautiful poetry, and she's a disabled poet and essayist from Kingston. And I'm very excited to read through her texts and sort of look at the intersections of how critical disability, educational access, and human rights essentially intersect and analyze that.
Yeah. It's interesting, the four chapters, and yes, you could easily have done a fifth chapter on rural. maybe after you've finished, because I'm sure that would be fascinating too. This whole concept of storytelling.
Yes.
We in academia, you hear it all the time, even when we're doing presentations. Tell a story. It's so much more exciting than just giving your facts of your research, because sometimes, depending on your field of study, it's harder to follow. So put it in a story so we get it. And it's always amazed me that we don't do more on storytelling from kids all the way through. So how do you think the impact of your research is going to have on students, educators, and the broader society? Knowing what you just told us about the four different chapters and why you were doing that, how do you think that's going to translate after?
Yeah, so I am hopeful in how my project will impact those three sectors. I one, hope to equip educators with anti-racist and decolonizing pedagogies that center student agency and support genuinely pluralistic classrooms where different knowledge systems can be introduced and validated, and so that we can imagine alternative classrooms, which then relates into alternative societies where we can uplift one another, where we can dwell in difference but still help one another. So that's my sort of big goal that may not happen, but I really hope it does. But outside of education, I think in general, what my project hopes to do is stress the importance of community praxis, of talking to one another, of dialogue, and centering care in all of our work rather than, say, economic success, right?
Yeah, that's a good point. Man.
Yeah, so that's what I'm really hoping for. And I think I'm taking small steps towards that. I had the pleasure of co-teaching with my wonderful supervisor, Dr. Heather McFarlane, who's still teaching English 380. It's a Literature and Culture in Canada course, but it's specifically looking at identities and dialogue and different solidarities that we can have.
Right.
My students were wonderful. I had a lot of concurrent education students. And to be able to teach the texts that I have been teaching, I think I've taught them sort of different methodologies of how to bring that into the classroom and have that impact in their future classrooms. So even if it's one small change, I sort of see it happening and I'm very grateful for them.
But it's interesting because I and I could be totally wrong, I would imagine at a university setting, it's easier to get people to think outside the box a little bit.
Yeah.
But with everything that's going on with the various contemporary issues in education these days, the big part of this is how do we get it into early stages of a child's life and into classroom, wherever that classroom is sitting, in a box or outside. You know, I think that's the harder part, isn't it? Because there's so many different views out there at the moment. You've got one side people saying, yes, we need to think more than just from our colonial system. But then they've got the other side, well, what's wrong with that?
Yeah.
And so how do you find this part? Because, I mean, there's a lot going on. There's a lot in the news these days about education.
It's difficult, I will say that, but there are people on the ground doing the work, and I really appreciate them and commend them because it's tireless work. But I think the biggest thing is getting out there and talking. Right now, Canada has a teacher shortage because our education system isn't supported as it should be. Classrooms are very large. Students aren't getting the attention that they need to get to be successful. And I think we have to sort of start there and improve those sectors. But also, I think in teacher education programs, we really have to talk about the importance of hearing diverse voices and why it's important to consistently have dialogue. Even in our families, people have different perspectives. So why do we expect our classroom to just have one, right?
That's a good point. Yeah. And I think reading is a good way to do that because people can all read it and go, okay, so what do you think?
Yeah.
Let's discuss this. You know, it opens the dialogue, doesn't it?
Yeah. And I think with reading in particular, it's such a long-term learning that really is intimate with the reader. It really promotes reflexivity. It really promotes that slow read and slow learning, which is not something I think a lot of people think about as much anymore, especially with access to things like ChatGPT or just having a phone in your hand and access to knowledge instantly. That idea of working through a text and having to read something long is valuable for all ages. It slows you down. And there's such benefit in going in that slow approach because that learning stays with you longer.
Yeah, we have to all learn to take a pause, don't we?
Yes.
Or a breath, not even a pause. Take a breath.
Yeah.
Everything is way too fast. And you're rightly so. I don't think we take things in as well when we go that fast.
Yeah, yeah.
You do need to take a bit of time.
And I know we mentioned book clubs, but I really think even in the home, having collective reading environments for different people is very important so that youth see that reading being modeled to them. So adults remember that we need to keep reading because learning never ends.
Correct.
And it sometimes, it can be a fun activity where different people will pick out a book for you instead of you reading something that only you would gravitate towards, right? So to have that even diversity in genre is important. And that's something I also hit in my dissertation. I have short stories, I have multimedia texts, I have poetry, because they're all literature and we have to bring them into the classroom.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting because I've never been, I wouldn't go and pick up a poetry book, but I know the value of poetry.
Yeah.
Unfortunately for me, poetry means it has to rhyme all the time, and that's not the case. And I've got to get out of that mindset myself, because there is a lot in poetry, whether they're short or long. There can be an awful lot. Although the long ones, I think, well, why don't you just call it a story? But that's my ignorance, I think, on that. You think also about musicians, you know, songwriters. That's another way of showing a book or a story.
Yeah. It's literature.
It is literature. Yeah. It's just sung instead of in a piece of, well, sometimes often it is on a piece of paper too, but most people sing it.
Yeah.
And I actually think in that way, it's actually easier to remember.
Yeah. Well, if that's the case, Colette, I do recommend checking out some of our department events, because we are now linked with creative writing and we have some wonderful authors who are phenomenal in our department, and we hold readings, we hold events, and I really recommend everyone check those out. Our department's also pretty cool. I am biased, but we have some wonderful people there writing and creating these amazing texts.
So, how far away are you from finishing? Or should I not ask that question?
Gosh, Paulette, you know, it's like asking someone's age.
I should never ask a PhD student how long they've got, because just when they think they're finished, they think of something else.
Yeah.
And we go, stop, that's enough.
I'm working at it. I'm trying to finish up. Again, I am extremely grateful for my supervisor, Heather, and all the guidance she's offered me, but also all the practical knowledge she's given me. I actually had her in undergrad in my English 215, which is a course that a lot of concurrent education students have to take because it's Canadian literature. Then I took all of her courses, and then I went away for my master's and came back, and I was like, Heather,
I'm back.
And the rest is history.
That's awesome.
Yeah, she's taught me a lot. She introduced me to diasporic literature formally, which is what I've been running with, I guess, for this now.
Well, clearly you're going to run with it a bit longer, even after you've got your PhD. So, you know, Basma, I wish you all the best with this. It's what you're talking about is fascinating, and I think we need to pay a bit more attention to that, and particularly what we can bring into the classroom or outside the classroom.
Yeah, I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with me, Colette, and it's always just lovely talking to you as well.
This is easy. You did all the talking.
No. But I think one thing, I mean, we agree on a lot of things, but do you agree that everyone should go out and get a public library card?
Absolutely. If you haven't done already, you know, Kingston Frontenac public library system is awesome. Those of you who've got children, there's great programming for the children as well. Yeah. And I don't know if, I think a lot of it's free, but just go and check them out anyway, because there's so much that's going on in the public libraries, not to be missed.
Yeah, for sure.
So get that public card library.
Yes, 100%.
Yeah. Well, Basma, we're going to have to call it quits. So again, thank you for coming on.
No worries. Thank you for having me. I finally did it. And I'm
you did.
Joyous about it.
So Yin's going to be very happy that you finally made it. So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat sadly comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download the show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and a CFIC podcast. Just type in Grad Chat. Until next week, this is CJ the DJ signing off with a big hooray. Grad Chat.
Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University, situated on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of the Faculty of Engineering and Applied Science.